Hello, I'm Muriel, and I love true crime.
I'm Nick, and I am not a fan.
Thank you for joining us. Each week, I force Nick to listen to me tell him a story of a true crime. Welcome to Muriel's Murders. Today, we're gonna enter a wild world I knew nothing about until now, the New York City club kids of the 90s. This episode has a lot of drugs and a lot of different kinds of drugs. Things like pee drinking and wiener swinging and a lot of violence. So listener beware, for sure.
Like so many drugs. Pee, for instance, poop, and penises.
Yeah, there's okay. A lot of all of that in this story.
We're getting every kind of high today.
We're about to deep dive into superstar club promoter Michael Alleg and the murder of Andre Angel Melendez. For this episode, I watched three documentaries. Party Monster, a shockumentary. Pretty good. You can find that on YouTube. Directed by Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato. I watched Glory Days, The Life and Times of Michael Alleg, directed by Ramon Fernandez, and Limelight, which is really interesting if you want to learn about how to make discos in the 90s. I mean, it was very
how
cool.
How to make discos in the 90s?
No, that's a dumb way of saying it. Of like, just like the saying? Most spectacular uh-huh. clubs in this period of history of dance clubs.
It's like electronic dance, like raves, basically?
Kind of, but not exactly. It's a great documentary. It's really interesting. It's mm-hmm. kind of cheesy, but it's got a lot of really interesting information. That's directed by Billy Corbin, who is not from the Smashing Pumpkins.
A different Billy Corbin?
Yeah, but maybe that guy's name's a different name.
Yeah, maybe it's...
At least Billy Corgan. I don't know.
No idea.
I also read a bunch of reporting from Frank Owen for The Village Voice. I want to just put a little caveat out there because mm-hmm. I just want to say it, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
I did my very best to piece this together. It's a really complicated story, made even more complicated by the fact that all the main characters were absolutely blasted off ecstasy and cocaine. and there are also kind of a fair amount of contradictions in our source material. It's a really polarizing story with an almost mythic quality at this point that, sure. you know, so some things have become other things over time. So depending on what you read or watch, you might get a different impression altogether. I tried to knit them all together. Yeah. This is my impression. Hold on to your butts for that one.
Great. Yeah, all no, right. I love this. You got fake Smashing Pumpkins guys making whole documentaries. This is awesome. All right, look, all the love needs to be sent to Possum Mom and Lisa R. for signing up for our Patreon. We just released our 39th and 40th Patreon exclusive true crime episodes. Those are hot off the presses
they're
and
really
out there
fun
for
too.
You.
We're, you, I think they're fun.
Guys, we're on fire. We're killing it. You need to get with the program. If you're into the show and you appreciate the work we put into it, for instance, Mira watching three documentaries and reading 100 stupid articles about every single story. You know, if you're like, man, this is good, now would be the perfect time to support Muriel's Murders by signing up either on Patreon or through Spotify. We have links in the show notes of this episode, and you can check out murielsmurders.com/support to learn all the juicy details.
Okay, this is a story involving murder, violence, drugs, so many drugs, adult themes like pee, etc. So if any listeners are like Nick and they don't want to hear about those kind of things, please consider listening to a different podcast.
We'll probably do a little cursing and joking, so if you're sensitive to that, turn us off.
All right, Nikki, are you ready to hear this story?
No.
Okay. Let's get started. We're returning to a time and place we have a boner for on this podcast. New York City in the mid-1980s. this sort of apocalyptic Wild West New York City when people like Nick's dad could rent a tenement apartment with no bathroom for $50 a month. We're talking the New York filled with abandoned, bombed out buildings, valuable waterfront real estate sitting empty next to trash filled water, crushed crack vials like gravel on the sidewalk, open prostitution, graffiti, gangs, violent crime, drugs. And then also
little baby Nick being born in 1984.
Yeah, okay, right. Sorry. That's totally true.
Yeah, that's where I was born.
And, you know, Keith Haring is out there doing his thing, and Jean-Michel Basquiat, and like this huge art scene with tons of subcultures, none of it mainstream, this heavily creative, buzzy place.
Yeah, hip hop is live and well.
Yeah. Back then, there weren't actually a lot of nightclubs. It was mostly like S&M clubs and super weird sex warehouses, apparently.
What?
Like, not a lot of, like, very much dance clubs. It was more like, you know.
It went from Studio 54 to Dungeon 69.
Oh, that's pretty good, Nick. Jeez Louise. So the back bar of Studio 54 was the center of the legit club scene, dominated by the celebutantes, that's wealthy Manhattan socialites and figures like Liza Minnelli, Baryshnikov, Elizabeth Taylor, Truman Capote, who we did a big series about earlier this summer, Salvador Dali, and then all headed up by It Boy himself.
I don't know what you're saying.
Andy Warhol.
Oh, okay. Salvador Dali was hanging out in New York City in the
80s? Yeah, he totally was.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Damn, sometimes. I missed that. That's cool. Walking around with an armadillo on a leash and everything. Or an anteater. Oh, he had anteaters. Whatever. Okay.
There were, though, some other clubs on the scene besides the sex warehouses. Not as big, but definitely home to some really interesting folks shunned from the Studio 54 scene who were clubbing it up in their own way. One of the alternatives to Studio 54 was Danceteria, which was considered one of the centers of new wave music in New York City. So little baby Madonna and Run DMC used to hang there. The same thing with the Beastie Boys when they were newbies. Billy Idol, Sade, The Smiths, Cyndi Lauper, Depeche Mode, Butthole Surfers.
So this is that's the cool kid club.
It's cool. Like, there's a lot of cool stuff
that's
happening.
That's the shit, like Blondie and everything.
Yeah. LL Cool J.
Hell yeah. CBGBs. Yeah, that's not a person. That's a place. But I'm just saying things now. I'm just like, put me there. I want to do that.
I wanted to do this story in a big part because everything, basically, like, this story reminds me so much of you. And really, the club scene that we're going to be talking about is literally your dreams and nightmares that you describe to me all the time. The big room with all the people in it. Yeah. So I think you're going to really... this is one in particular. I was like, oh, I can't wait to tell you about this.
Beautiful.
So in Danceteria, where all these people are coming up, LL Cool J is licking his lips, right? One of the busboys there was a college kid named Michael Alec. Alec was born in tiny South Bend, Indiana. We've been there, right? Yeah, it's like Notre Dame and
fast food
and nothing else. That was the first time I went to what's that place?
Oh, Shake Shack.
Yeah, which was kind of crazy.
We went to Shake Shack. They have fast food Italian plate. Remember, you get fast food spaghetti somewhere?
Yeah, right. Yeah,
it was like 150 degrees, all humidity, and then every place you walked in was like 30 degrees with air conditioning.
Oh, yeah, and it was
so incredibly freezing and then ridiculously hot and humid. Okay.
So we have South Bend, Indiana, a milk-fed Midwestern boy is who we're talking about. Mm-hmm. He had this fresh, preppy look, really sweet with dimples on his cheeks. Michael was gay, and at the time, South Bend was a really rough place to grow up for an LGBTQ kid. He wrote a gossip column for the school newspaper. He was a straight-A student and just was mercilessly bullied throughout high school. And as soon as he turned 18, he decided to get out. And at the time, if you were artistic or adventurous, queer, any type that didn't fit comfortably in your hometown and you wanted out, the choice was basically New York City or Los Angeles. Sorry, Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, Chicago at the time was not not on the map for with open arms.
Michael went to NYC to check things out and landed at, on St. Mark's Place in the East Village. And he said at the time it was like this intoxicating, decadent, dilapidated carnival. And he decided to go to any college that would get him close to the East Village and ended up enrolling in Fordham University in the Bronx on an academic scholarship. All right. So there were a few danceterias, but the one we're talking about was this wild ass spot in a 12-story industrial building in the Flatiron District. One of the founders was Rudolph Piper, who had the task of booking insane acts to fill all the stages on these floors, right? It's this huge building. Mm. He booked a woman named Hennessy Brown, whose act was basically squirting her booby milk into the crowd and then pulling magician's hanky out of her vagina.
Oh, that's good.
Apparently she could do like 100 hankies.
Oh my God.
A lot. Like, that's what people say. I was trying to find more information about her, and I read a bunch of like message boards, and I was like, that can't be true. But apparently, that's what she was known
okay.
for.
That is magic.
He also booked this group called Missing Foundation, which was this sort of performance art, anarchist, industrial music act. And they didn't really use instruments. They just used found metal objects. Rudolph Piper said the band would sometimes just throw barbed wire on the stage and then roll around naked on it.
Just setting the bar for high school art projects for the rest of eternity.
Right. And this is where Michael Alec entered the club scene, doing a lame go-go dancing act in a talent show at the Danceteria and bussing tables as like a 19-year-old. Mm-hmm. Sometime in the mid-80s, Michael pitched an event to Rudolph Piper, the Filthy Mouth Contest. Basically a contest where anyone in the audience could come on stage and get up there and roast people in the audience. And that seems really fun, right? It was like way intense, like maybe more intense than that description entails.
Like not jokes, just being mean or something.
I don't know. Okay, I read this article from the New York Post that interviewed Michael Alec about this time, and he said, quote, the contest was whoever shocked the audience most would win $100, and it devolved into public masturbation with beer bottles. Everyone was riveted. They couldn't leave the room. I don't know what the take was that night, like the first night, but I got paid $500. Thank God I quit college. I thought, I'm going to be a millionaire. I've had those thoughts running through my head for sure.
I feel that way recording this episode right now.
So Rudolph Piper loved it, right? Michael did too. And pretty soon he was a college dropout trying to break into the scene as a club promoter. His first really big party night was called Consumer Hell. They stole 10 shopping carts from a store in New Jersey and then brought them into, I believe it was a different club, but one of Rudolph's clubs. They brought them into the club and put a loop of commercials on the TVs. That's the only thing they were playing. Mm-hmm. Michael's outfit was made out of junk food boxes. So he had an Oreo box hat and Fruit Loop earrings. And he told the New York Post, quote, people arrived in saran wrap dresses stuffed with Cheerios and Fluffer Nutter. It was crazy.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And this is just him first when he enters the scene.
Yeah.
In 1987.
I love this. That's like the version of rising through the corporate ranks or something.
Yeah.
Like jack off on stage. Okay. Incorporate a beer bottle. They're like $500. He's like, wear garbage. They're like $5,000. He's
it's that.
To the moon.
Yeah, to the moon, baby. Hold on. In 1987, Andy Warhol died and ushered in the death of downtown. The celebutante era came to a close. The club scene, as people knew it, dried up, and Michael Alec wanted to fill the void. Former celebutante James St. James, who's this, you'll recognize him usually. Mm-hmm. He's like a commentary guy. He's written a bunch of books. He used to call Michael Alec a baby Godzilla. He said when Michael Alec came on the scene, he horrified everyone.
Yeah.
While the Celebutante set was more about like trust funds and glamour, you know, Andy Warhol's thing about people being famous for being famous.
Uh-huh.
What Michael Alec brought to town was like a parody of that, which was already a parody of something, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He brought a parody of that scene, almost absurdist celebrity movement, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He would find people in the club scene who had a vibe and then groom them into his own brand of celebrity. So he'd basically round up people who dressed super bizarrely or really creatively or really costumey, right?
Mm-hmm.
And made sure that they got into clubs he was promoting and added them to his entourage. So the scene that was dominated by class and propriety gave way to guys in like space hats wearing feathered thong leotards.
Hell yeah. This is awesome. It kind of reminds me, this is like the New York version of what John Waters was doing in Baltimore with like Divine and his whole, I forget what they were called. Oh, they had like a crew name. They're like all the brilliant maniacs coming out of Baltimore at the time.
Yeah,
anyways,
yeah.
They were, I think, proudly sort of like more blue collar kind of thumbing their nose at, oh, you're cool from New York kind of vibe,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
But it's similar.
Yeah. That's super interesting. Okay. And then the other thing going on is at the very end of 1985, the minimum drinking age in New York City was raised from 19 to 21. And that had two sort of unintended effects.
Uh-huh.
One, for some reason, that just meant teens started going out to clubs like in hordes, way more than they did before. And two, it became super chic to have underage kids at your club.
Oh, great.
Which, according to these documentaries, police just turned a blind eye to for several years.
Sure, sure. Well, I love that. Teenagers are like, oh, wait, we're not allowed there?
Yeah,
we're going.
And Michael Alec became the Pied Piper of this youth club set. So that's how the club kids were born. Basically, underage kids in insane costumes. The aesthetic was theatrical, cartoonish, anti-fashion, sort of deliberately uncool. People who would have never been able to get into Studio 54 were now a part of this, you know, cool scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very sexual, gender bending sort of thing. And at the same time, very infantile. Like some clubs at the time had a no lunchbox policy to keep out club kids who would like come into the clubs with little cartoon lunch pails or baby bottles. It's just like a whole thing. And if you were hanging with the club kids, what you would do is you'd spend basically all day making your costume. And it wasn't really about money spent, but creativity or expression.
Right.
Or if not that, then just gutsiness. Like put on a stupid hat, put on a glitter, like make up a theme for your costume and just go for it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the big celebrities in this scene now, instead of going by their names, went by nicknames. So it was Reuben Sandwich and Oliver Twisted. RuPaul was one of the club kids, the original club kids.
Oh, amazing. Man, I hate that this story is going to turn dark. Why does everything good just end up...
Human nature, baby!
Sucks.
Arguably, Michael Alec's big break came with Peter Gation and his club Limelight in the late 80s. So Peter Gation is this super fascinating character. I had to add him in. He was originally from Canada and he lost his eye playing hockey. So he got a settlement from that. And then he used the settlement to open a rock bar where he was living in Canada. He sold the rock bar, invested in disco in the US, opened clubs in Miami and Atlanta, and then finally came to New York City where he opened Limelight. And at this point, because he'd been working in disco, he felt like the neon disco synthetic thing had gone as far as it could go. So he wanted his new club to be architectural and design forward. He wanted a historical building and specifically a church. So he ended up buying the Episcopal Church of Holy Communion, which was this 120-year-old church for $1.7 million.
Damn. I feel like this is just the archetype of every like club scene in The Matrix and John Wick. And yeah. anytime it's like
uncha, uncha, it is, uncha, it uncha, is.
And like someone's getting assassinated, it's like this guy's original vision for a club.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is the guy, yeah. right? One of the most creative club. And we're going to go into how his clubs were.
Sure, sure.
So this is a historical building. The outside had to mm-hmm. be preserved as a church, right? But the inside, Gayshen spent $5 million renovating. He put in all of these multiple tiered balconies up the vaulted ceilings. He built a VIP lounge. He had all these hanging cages that would descend from the ceiling for dancers to be inside.
Oh, yeah. He invented. That's hilarious. Yeah. Everyone who's ever done any kind of movie from then until now just owes that vision to this guy.
This is the guy.
Hilarious.
Right? So around 1988, Peter Gayshen was a handsome, shadowy man with an eye patch. He would just lurk in the corners. He was really very mysterious, was notorious for not really drinking or doing any drugs mm-hmm. and just working 18-hour days. Mm. But he would then go on basically just have these like coke orgies that, uh-huh. like twice a year that would last 5 or 6 days. So he only did all his drugs in 5 or 6 days twice a year. And the rest of the time he was this sober, eye patch wearing, lurking man in the shadows.
So he's the smartest human being I've ever heard of. What? That's so smart. So a brilliant... That's the way to do it. He's just a millionaire. He's just a workaholic. And then he takes 2 vacations and only does drugs and has orgies. Why didn't I think of that?
All right. So he opens Limelight like 1982, uh-huh. I think around then. And then by 1988, you know, it was really well known and it was popping. It was making money. Mm-hmm. But it was a lot more like a tourist trap. It was a place where people really went to go see this uh-huh. club and a church, you know?
Yeah.
And he was having a little trouble filling one of his rooms and he threw it to Michael Alec, who had been, you know, promoting stuff for the last couple of years to promote. The night that Alec took over blew up, and when Gayshen saw his VIP room packed with like sexy astronaut teens, he was like, cha-ching, this is going to be huge, right? And that's when Michael Alec was given the green light to debut Disco 2000 on Wednesday nights at Limelight. Now, I feel like this has to be what that Stefan bit from SNL Bill Hader did was based on. New York's hottest club is Corpse Penis.
Yeah, right.
You know, pitch black, no drinks, only the sounds of screech owls play over the loudspeaker, you know, whatever.
Yeah, right.
Now, for his debut night of Disco 2000, Michael Alec went and rented a bunch of animal mascot costumes, just like the full deal.
Uh-huh.
And he rented them under a fake name and stole them. And they became like iconic to the scene. Like, he had a couple club kids who played the characters. So there was Claire the chicken, Icy the bear, Ulrich the dog were a few, and they would just come in to and like hype up the crowd and just like voguing and walking around the club. Claire the chicken had a swing. They built a swing for that character that swung across the entire length of this dance floor. And we're talking mm-hmm. about a dance floor that accommodates about 2,500 people. And she would just, that character would just swing over the floor.
Oh, so that's like a trapeze. Like, yeah, that's intense.
In a giant swing. James St. James, our celebutant, or the guy who was, you know, a former celebutant, had ditched the celebutants to join the club kids. And on the inaugural night of Disco 2000, he played this character called the Drug Child. So he wore this long wig and he sat in a cage with all these signs around saying, "Do not feed the drug child." And then he just sat in the cage and rattled the bars and begged people for a bump of cocaine.
It's either so fun or so exhausting.
That's what everybody says. Like, it's like half the people are like, "Oh, it was the most amazing thing." And the other people are like, "He was so exhausting. I could not stand. The club kids were the worst."
Can I get one ride on the swing? It looks really fun. Claire the chicken won't stop clucking.
So thousands of people showed up. It quickly became the most insane night out of the whole week. It would go till 5 a.m. on a Wednesday, and people were just out there having sex in the open. They had, you know, these go-go dancers descending from the ceiling in cages. Michael was out there just inventing things. It was pre-internet, so it's not like he was Googling archives, right? He put his mom in a shopping cart and pushed around the dance floor. He bought in bales of hay and live chickens. He built an indoor water slide, which does not seem safe. And also, they built a homemade Ferris wheel, which also does not seem safe.
I mean, none of that. I mean, also having live chickens isn't safe. None of it is safe.
They started the hot body contest.
I like how you're like, none of it's safe. They're literally doing drugs. It's just like, it's like obviously unsafe.
I'm just saying, like, I'm not going to, water slide, you just get like a nail in your butt or something. It'd be horrible.
They're getting all types of things in their butts, Miriam. Okay, sliding or not sliding.
So they started the hot body contest. They'd hype up the crowd until people got on stage and got buck ass naked. Mm-hmm. The prize was just $50, but people would just kind of get super hyped and start like stripping and doing crazy stuff on stage.
Yeah, you're not doing it for the money at that point.
Yeah, and then there were like actual orgies going on in different parts of the club. So Michael's parties would bring in around 2,500 people every Wednesday night. And there was a kind of positive, posy chaos. Like, it brought in all kinds of people. Suburb kids, tough guys from Staten Island on ecstasy, drag queens, tourists, goths, whatever. Mm-hmm. And of course, the club kids were there in full effect. And a big thing at the time was wearing unitards with the butt cut out and crazy hats. So that was like a huge element of what was going on.
Basically, nothing on the butt, put it all on the head.
Basically, your looks all had to have a character, like perverted sex clown or robot mutant or whatever. And I just want to say, I might be crazy.
Yeah.
But did our longtime listener and dear friend Green Door Brad say that he was a club kid? I swear to God.
You know, I've heard that term, club kid, and I don't know.
I think he was like, I used to wear a crazy costume and go to the club. Don't you remember him saying that?
He did. Brad. He did. Brad, Billy, Cecily, someone get Brad on the phone.
I'm pretty sure that he used to be. I think this is what he used to do. Because he was trying to describe it to me, and I was like, what are you talking about?
No, you're right. He did talk about that. Right. Yeah.
I think I came home and I was like, Brad City.
He's like, what do you mean? You just like Sonic the Hedgehog? What do you mean?
I know. Well, and also because like when I knew him, he was like a fairly, not a conservative person, but like, you know, clean cut, wore like a
Yeah, he was always well dressed.
Yeah.
In great shape.
Yeah.
Had his life together.
Yeah, totally. Like, I mean, I don't even think he wore jewelry. And one tasteful tattoo. He's like, yeah, I used to wear my hair was down to my butt. Man, he's crazy. I was just like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
I realized that.
I wonder if he was doing that in New York or if it had spread. Anyways.
I think he was doing it in New York for like a hot second when he was like a teenager. I feel like he said, I just didn't get it, but now I kind of get it. When somebody explains it to you and you don't know, you're just like, what?
The weird thing is like being, you know, I remember when we went to Nova, so Muriel and I met at this alternative school in Seattle, and there were kids, you know, I considered myself kind of like in the know, or, you know, I didn't think of myself as a square. And then you would just find out about people doing stuff sort of adjacent to this that you just had no idea about. And it was always just so shocking.
That's,
you know,
I mean, I feel like that about everything. Yeah, I'm always just like, yeah, we're all just doing stuff. And then I'm like, wow, I really don't know about that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Okay. So Limelight just had this incredible energy. At one point, it was the only place in New York City where you could hear techno. They brought techno into the mainstream through this venue, apparently. They'd be doing 3-day raves with DJs playing 18-hour sets, just like wild.
Again, fun / exhausting.
Mm-hmm. It didn't actually start out as a huge drug scene. Coke was around, but more of a privately done thing. But MDMA hit the scene in the U.S. in the 80s, and I didn't know this, but it wasn't illegal. So MDMA is ecstasy. It wasn't illegal in New York City on a state level until 1996.
Damn.
So there was a federal ban on and off in the 80s, and then again starting in 1989. But I guess if you got busted with it in New York City prior to 1996, cops would just take it and throw it in the trash, but you wouldn't even get like a ticket.
You just go get it out of the trash.
Yeah.
I'll take, oh, it's like Molly now, right?
Well,
yeah, I think Molly and ecstasy is the same thing.
I don't know.
Yeah, anyways, I'll eat some trash, Molly.
So obviously, yes, people were doing a lot of ecstasy, which gave way to other things. At these clubs, they started making ecstasy punch, which is you crush a bunch of ecstasy, put it in a 55-gallon drum, mix it into a punch, and then serve it from the DJ booth.
Very good.
There was a spot in Limelight, like an unsanctioned hole, where if you stuck in $15, someone would just hand you like a rocks glass with champagne, vodka, and crushed up magic mushrooms.
Hell yeah.
They played a game called What's My Line? So they'd have all these lines of white powdered drugs like...
Hold on, I'm so sorry. I'm cutting you off and I don't mean to. But I said, hell yeah. That would be so nasty. Shrooms and champagne.
And vodka.
And it's cold.
Yeah.
Like,
no, I didn't even know if it had ice in it. I mean, it was just... I think that sounds so gross. But it does the trick, right?
Yeah, I mean, anyways, they has to be really ground up. It can't just be crushed up. Anyways,
well, okay. They played this game called What's My Line? Hilarious. And so they had all these lines out, like crystal meth, cocaine, like anything you could snort that's in a powdered form. And then people would come up and do a line. And if they could properly ID it, they could continue on. So if you did right, you could do another line, and then whoever was still standing at the end was the winner.
Oh, how did no one die? I guess just...
No, people died.
Yeah. Okay.
The rumor at first was that Michael Alec really didn't do any drugs. He was kind of notoriously anti-drug, but he was an agent of chaos. Like, he handed out drugs openly. He used to walk up to people and say, open your mouth, and then like put ecstasy in your mouth. He liked to pretend he was trashed and fall down hard on the floor, cut himself. He would like pretend to be drunk and knock full trays of drinks out of waiters' hands.
Just like a Three Stooges sketch or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And since the whole, you know, it was just all built on extremes. The whole scene was built on extremes. And Disco 2000 naturally escalated to outlaw parties. So just with flyers, no cell phones or internet, Michael Alec started these outlaw parties. And they were basically anarchistic flash mob parties in places like Dairy Queen or a grocery store or a deserted bank. He did a really famous one in the McDonald's in Times Square where he just like had this box of hamburgers and he was chucking them at people in the audience, in the crowd.
So people just show up and start dancing or whatever.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So like one they held in a donut shop, then it was just everybody inside rolling joints and eating donuts under fluorescent lights, blaring techno music and the chickens out there dancing, tearing it up. Sometimes a couple thousand people would show up, and the parties usually lasted only 15 minutes before the cops would shut it down. Mm-hmm. But they were like the wildest parties. And they were pretty illegal. Michael would use bolt cutters to break into places. Apparently one time he stole a city bus. By now, Michael Alec and the Club Kids were becoming a national sensation. They were appearing on TV. They were on MTV. They appeared a bunch of times on the Geraldo Show, on the Joan Rivers Show. And basically, Michael Alec was the prince of the club scene and the leader of a movement, sort of the guy who gathered all the misfits and made them club gods. And his appearances on TV drew young people from all over the country to come and join the club scene.
Was the Geraldo Rivera and Joan Rivers kind of like, you know, youth led astray? Like, this is the concerning trend happening. And now the Pied Piper of all these.
Yeah, yeah. And then they'd show up and they'd be wearing like the most outrageous costumes, like cone fingernails and just being, you know, they were paired up with that. It's 9 o'clock. Do you know where your kids are?
Yeah.
Which I was making fun of the other night because I was like, it's so funny that 20, 30 years ago, they needed to be a commercial that was like, it's 9 o'clock. Do you know where your kids are? Because people would just be like, nope. Like, why do you need a commercial?
Now,
for
like
that?
Every kid has got a TikTok live stream or something going on.
It speaks to that time when people said, oh, back in the day.
Yeah.
When I think about like not having a cell phone and just being out.
Yeah, of course.
You know, nobody knew where I was at 17, in the, that's kind of what it's just like. You call your mom from like a payphone and you tell her you're somewhere, but you're not there. You know.
Also, are we going to talk about how shady it is that this guy is pretending to be doing drugs and while giving everyone else drugs?
That only lasted for a short period of time. Like,
because it's just like shady. He's just like, you know, it's just a manipulation.
Yeah.
And then he's able to function really highly, pull off these crazy stunts that and apparently make money.
It did not last for very long. It was like in the very, very beginning of this thing. Mm-hmm. And the drugs thing really, really changed. It turned a corner. We'll get into that.
I do want to say that I think the best job in the whole world would be being a club promoter where you pay all the waitresses and be like, hey, look, like three times a shift, I'm going to come and knock over your tray of drinks.
Yeah.
They're going to tip you like $500. Like, it literally doesn't matter.
And you just do brutal pratfalls.
That sounds really fun.
By the early 90s, Peter Gation had a monopoly on clubs in New York City. He had Limelight, the Palladium, Tunnel, and Club USA. So Limelight, of course, was the flagship. And then in 1992, Gation acquired Palladium and Tunnel. Palladium was sort of a futuristic club with lava lamps and glowing electric orbs. I don't even know. That's what they say they are. I don't know what that means. Furry furniture. And then they had this showcase. You like to have these staircases that were showcases in the room. So this one was a giant circular staircase that lit up, that like if you walked on it, you were just looked like you were walking into heaven. And the crowd there was a little more high fashion, but still absurd and surreal, like, you know, gold painted man in a tiny thong and platform shoes. There was still that element, but it was a little more refined, right?
Now, yeah, it's not Buckingham Palace.
Tunnel was in an old railroad freight terminal back in the days when trains used to just go directly into warehouses. Mm-hmm. So it was shaped like a tunnel because trains used to go through it. And the dance floor was built over the train tracks. And it had this long, cavernous room and then tons of different offshoot rooms and other floors. And the rooms were all designed by different, you know, well-known architects. Mm-hmm. There were lounges, Victorian-style libraries. There were S&M dungeons, like whatever. You could be walking through and like go into a room and have no idea what you were going to find.
Yeah, so this definitely is a reoccurring element in my dreams.
Yes, yeah.
It's like this huge space where you're just like, man, there's this room like over there and it's like I haven't been there in a year and I know it's crazy in there.
Yeah.
And there's people everywhere. Yeah. Okay.
Right. And then what people say is like basically when you got in, it was impossible to find your way out.
Yeah.
You would just be, now I live here.
Uh-huh.
The bathroom was 50 stalls long and then it had a DJ playing at both ends.
Oh, the poop DJ.
And there were like chandeliers everywhere. Again, dancers hanging in cages. The less tasteful among us gave it the nickname Auschwitz in Las Vegas.
Okay.
Sundays at the Tunnel ended up being one of the most influential hip hop nights in New York City, according to Source Magazine. Peter Gation built Club USA that same year, which is arguably the wackiest. It's a four-story, $8 million club with an adult slide that connected the top and bottom floors and then this huge staircase that led to nowhere. It had a scam aesthetic, so kind of like the American scheme was the idea. Give us money because we're fabulous. We're not going to give you anything. At his height, Peter Gation was bringing in around $600,000 a week from the four clubs. So that's a lot.
Yeah. Yep.
And his star promoter was Michael Alec. So at this point, really, drugs were just so, so, so huge. Mm-hmm. Crystal meth, heroin, ecstasy, acid, mushrooms, crack. It was literally everything. Michael would blow up a bunch of balloons, fill some of them with ecstasy pills, and then just like release them over the dance floor for people to play with. And the vibe wasn't really like, oh, I like one particular drug.
Uh-huh.
It was, we do all of the drugs at the same time, all of the time. Yeah. Like premix combos were really, really popular at the time. Like Zek, which is Xanax, ecstasy, crystal meth, and ketamine all mixed together in one like concoction. At this point, I'm like, what does that even do?
You just lose your mind.
For a while, Michael Alex Saint was just, he loved ketamine. James St. James, our guy, he had a really interesting way of describing ketamine at the time. So this is a quote that I took off of one of these documentaries. Mm-hmm. So he says, once you get past the K hole, you can get into K land, which is what I call it. And that's where, like, all of a sudden you're like Queen Victoria, you know, traipsing around Buckingham Palace, and you don't really know where you are and you don't know who you are or what's going on, but it doesn't matter. Everything sort of makes sense, even though nothing makes sense. And it's a gorgeous feeling. And that's what we've all been searching for. All the club kids, you know, is to have our own little world.
That's so funny. This guy spent millions of dollars to make these beautiful clubs. And these people are like, dude, you could just take drugs and be anywhere. It doesn't even matter. He's like, what the? Why?
That's, we're going there, right? So they started doing ketamine, uh-huh. Special K. They got bored of that and then really transitioned over to doing heroin, which we all know is like, you know.
Yeah, Sleep Town, Deathville.
Right. And this scene was all about extremes. So heroin became part of the aesthetic. People went from dancing and waving their arms to just staring at the floor in a K-hole. Every day, Alec was on, usually on cocaine, heroin, ketamine, some sort of sedative, and sometimes a little crack and ecstasy thrown in. He said once he was grocery shopping while in a K-hole and accidentally rammed a guy at the store with his shopping cart. And then that guy turned out to be from Limelight. So he gave Alec a bump of cocaine just like in the grocery store to get him going again. As the drugs took over the scene, Disco 2000 got way, way more extreme and grotesque and crazy. Michael found a guy who would drink his own pee on stage. He had a lady, Ida Slapter. He would give her, like, she would give herself a...
Probably shouldn't laugh at that
name. Ida Slapter.
Ida Slapter.
She would give herself...
That's the best name. The worst name, but that's the best name.
She would give herself champagne enemas and then shoot the champagne out of her butt into the crowd.
That's good.
One, I wouldn't like that. One of Michael Alex's gnarliest parties was Blood Feast. It was based on this gory horror movie, which actually will come back. We'll talk about that. So just all out gore, eating brains, fake blood, coffins, but all really kitschy and super fake. So they put people in corpse makeup and glass boxes. There were buckets of fake blood all over the club. And James St. James himself, like, he covered himself in mashed up calf liver. And throughout the night, he just couldn't stop gagging at the smell. But that was all part of the thing, right? Apparently, at one point, Michael Alec caught hepatitis and then tried to spread it all around the club, French kissing people and drinking their drinks. And then everyone for like a period of time in the club scene thought they had hepatitis. And Michael Alec made this dark joke thing called the Wheel of Hepatitis. So he made this big sort of Wheel of Fortune thing with all these people's faces from the scene, like photographs of them, and then like how they may have gotten hepatitis. And then you spin the wheel and whoever you land on is the way that you would get hepatitis, which is like, it's getting like, what's going on, right? Hepatitis. He used to go up on the balcony.
Tuberculosis and the plague and everything.
He used to go up on the balconies and then pee on people from the balconies at Limelight. He just like pee off them and like hit them in the head.
Okay.
One of the drag queens who used to help him host events was like, oh yeah, during that period, Michael was super crazy. He tricked me into drinking his pee and vomit two different times.
Like, not again.
An unofficial system of club-sponsored drug dealers emerged during this time. And from what I gathered, Michael started cultivating drug dealers to hand out stuff at his parties and the clubs. Mm-hmm. This is controversial. Like, Peter Gation has never been proved to be connected to any drug stuff and has always said, like, I never, like, that's a blind eye thing. Basically, he said, I never paid attention to drugs, did drugs, or sanctioned any drugs. Mm-hmm. But there were people, like, basically hired at Limelight to hand out drugs.
Right. He's so. Like, and it's his club. And he's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. So one of those dealers was a man named Andre Melendez, who went by Angel. And he was one of those kids who heard of the scene and came from outside of the city to join in. So Angel was originally from Colombia and had lived in New Jersey since he was 8 years old. And when he got to be, I believe, like in his early 20s, he decided to come out and, you know, follow this club scene that was emerging in New York City. His signature look was feathery white angel wings, sometimes paired with white eyebrows and a toga, sort of like the movie Barbarella. And for a lot of people who couldn't penetrate the club kid inner circle, becoming a drug dealer was a way to get in there. So allegedly, Angel sold drugs at Limelight as like a small-time dealer, and he also supplied drugs for these private, days-long, coke-fueled orgies that Peter Gation liked to hold twice a year at the Four Seasons.
Oh, so that's like extra inner circle.
But this way of breaking into the inner circle had its drawbacks, so you could be labeled as a poser, and this seemed to be part of
I love how these kids were like, we need to have something for the outs, for the misfits, outcasts. Well, and now they're like, you're a poser.
That's really how things happen. And you know, there's some debate as to whether or not it was truly a place for misfits to go. Like they started their own hierarchy immediately. But whatever that is, the poser thing seemed to become a part of Angel's reputation in the scene. Like there was a little tension, maybe some gossip about him being annoying or a hanger-on, and it was also something he was known to be really sensitive about. In 1993, Rudy Giuliani was elected mayor of New York City on the platform of cleaning up the city and cracking down on crime. By the mid-90s, Peter Gation and his bacchanalian club empire was Giuliani's white whale. And in September 1995, federal agents raided Limelight, shut it down, and launched an investigation into Peter Gation for drug charges and racketeering, I believe. So allegedly, Angel was working at Limelight, dealing drugs at the time of the raid. And then after the raid, he was fired and he moved in with Michael Alleg, who was just straight up in a drug spiral. So cops were cracking down on all the Gation clubs, just standing around the dance floors in uniform, freaking everybody out. The DEA had undercover officers on the scene, like big beefy men dressed like club kids trying to infiltrate the clubs. Heroin had just really rocked Alec and the whole club kid movement. Yeah. And things were sort of coming apart at the seams. Things are probably as grim as you can imagine in Michael Alec's apartment, which was funded by Peter Gation. Tensions were high. Brains were addled. James St. James said, for instance, in the winter of 1996, after the big raid, there was a snowstorm and Angel was like out somewhere. And James St. James was snowed in with Michael Alec. And he said they ended up just doing a couple $1,000 worth of Angel's drugs. And by the time Angel came back, there wasn't any pretense to even replace them. Michael just didn't care. And according from reporting from the Village Voice, the conflict really began to escalate when Michael just stole about $2,000 in cash from Angel. And Angel beat him pretty badly in the head with a platform shoe. So Limelight's back open by now, and Angel was still owed money from past work. And there's a lot of like conflicting stories about this because, again, this is just coming from people who were on so many drugs, sort of like remembering whatever happened like years later. But the bones of it are is basically Angel was still owed some money for his past work at Limelight, but and he wasn't getting paid. And Michael Alec had instructed bouncers to turn him away from the club if he showed up looking for his money. And that's such a, that was a humiliating, sort of infuriating slap in the face. Cause it's not like, it's not just that, oh, we're not going to pay you. Yeah. It's also, you can't get into the club.
Right.
And it was even more so humiliating because Alec actually didn't even work for Gation anymore. He had been fired after his drug use escalated to just straight up alternating heroin and crack, and Michael had just refused to go to rehab. So after all of these tiny bits of injustice.
Yeah, I mean, spring, it's not that tiny. It's
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. In the spring of 1996, Angel Melendez had had enough. So I guess not to make too light of it, if you were to picture a murder that came from this particular place and time, I think this would probably be the murder.
Oh, no.
On Sunday, March 17th, 1996, at 10 a.m., around 10 a.m., Angel Melendez had it out with Michael Alig. Michael was living in a luxury apartment paid for by Peter Gation at the Riverbank West. Michael said he had been partying for something like four straight days. He hadn't slept. He hadn't eaten anything. When Angel came to the lobby of the building and demanded to be let upstairs. I read this article about how, according to Michael, at the time, Angel had just been rejected from bouncers at the Limelight, like at five in the morning or something like that. And there's some sort of like argument. He was there to get money, but also like there had been this planned raid by the DEA to like round up drug dealers, and they didn't want any drug dealers there. So like that was part of the reason why they didn't.
Oh, it's like, it's not personal, dude. You're just like, we can't have you guys in here right now.
That's what Michael said, right? Yeah. But Michael's also the only person who said that. Sure. And so that's why some of these things, it's a little hard to tease out like exactly what happened. That's Michael's version. But whatever happened, that was the night that Angel was rejected by the bouncers at the Limelight in front of his friends who he thought he was going to get into the club.
Right.
So Angel comes upstairs and he's really upset and he's like, you need to pay me. You owe me this money. And they start to fight. And it was like Michael Alig was just out of his mind on drugs, very tired, didn't want to deal with it. Said, I'll take you to the club later, but right now I'm going to take a nap. And they get into this screaming match. And according to Michael, his friend Robert Riggs, a.k.a. Freeze, who was also at the apartment, told Angel something along the lines of, this is why nobody likes you. If you weren't a drug dealer, you wouldn't have any friends. And according to Michael, Angel freaked out at this and pushed Michael through the glass front of his china cabinet, cutting up Michael's back. So there's blood everywhere from the cut in Michael's back, and Angel jumps on top of him and is just biting him and strangling him, and Michael started screaming for help. Freeze said that he just couldn't get Angel to stop biting and attacking Michael, so he grabbed a nearby hammer and he hit Angel three times on the back of the head until Angel stopped fighting. Freeze later said that he turned to then see Michael smothering Angel with a sweatshirt or a pillow and then pour Drano into Angel's mouth.
Jesus. Like after he's unconscious?
Right. And then there's another rumor that I think is pretty much not the case where they said they injected Drano into Angel's body. Michael, for his part, said the Drano part never happened. The sweatshirt part did. Like he wrapped a sweatshirt on his fist and was like hitting Angel. Mm-hmm. But that nothing with the Drano happened at this point. They mostly agree on what happened next. After a few hours, they thought Angel was just knocked out, right? So they left him on the floor. And after a few hours, he didn't get back up again. So they thought they might be able to revive him if they submerged him in water. They, instead of like calling the police or checking for his pulse, and they dragged him into the bathroom, dunked him under some water, but there weren't any air bubbles and he didn't revive, right? He wasn't breathing. Now, some say at this point, they may have had a fair shot of claiming self-defense if they had called police based on what their story is. Others say that Michael had actually been talking about killing Angel in the months prior. Not plotting, right? But definitely doing things like he's in this months-long conflict with Angel. He's living with Angel. He's taking Angel's drugs, right?
And money.
And so like he had been known to like do a bunch of coke and then just say, oh, I want to kill Angel over and over again. So that was in the ether. And then also, just for whatever it's worth, the poster for that gore rave blood feast that he had held earlier, had a picture of someone eating a dismembered corpse. There was a hammer in the shot, and then the phrase "legs cut off" printed on the flyer. So these are all elements of the crime that we'll find the leg cutting off thing happens later.
Oh no.
So even if it wasn't premeditated, there was just definitely something in the ether, right? Michael said that they didn't call police because the apartment was filled with Angel's drugs. So instead, they poured ice, baking soda, and Drano over his body in an attempt to keep it from smelling or decomposing. And then they left the apartment to go do all of Angel's drugs at a friend's house. So Michael and Freeze were gone for about a week, but eventually they knew it was time to go back and deal with whatever was at the apartment. Michael kept trying to convince Freeze that Angel might not even be there when they get back, right? He might have just woken up and ran off. So they were kind of hoping.
That's a great thing to tell your drugged out brain.
Right, exactly. So he's like, we were really hoping we were going to show up and this would just not be a problem.
We figured it was like 50-50, you know, worst case. So, probably 60-40 our favor.
So about 5 to 7 days later, they came back, but as you might have guessed, Angel was still in the tub.
Damn.
Freeze and Michael dealt with the decomposing body by dumping more baking soda in Drano and then banning people from using that bathroom, just barricading the door shut.
But still having people over?
They were still totally like partying and stuff. They told people whoever came over to party that the smell was like bad plumbing in the building. So people like James St. James was like, yeah, it was really stinky, but he was like, oh, there's open sewage. Something is happening. That bathroom is, you can't use that bathroom.
That's so sad.
About 10 days into this ordeal, Freeze went out and bought new kitchen knives and a meat cleaver from Macy's. Michael said if Freeze gave him 10 bags of heroin, he would take the bullet and dismember Angel's body because they couldn't move the body. It was too big in one piece.
Mm-hmm.
Michael said he then did a crap ton of heroin and cut the legs off of Angel's body while Freeze stood in the bathroom spraying Calvin Klein Eternity. Then
that is so bleak.
It's just like the bleakest. It's like, you know, when like the tide, like the wave comes in and then like the tide goes back and there's just garbage on the shore. Just like this wave of CK incredible like club imagination and everything. And then it's just like the grossest thing underneath. So they took the legs, they put them in duffel bags and dumped them in the Hudson River. And they put the upper half of Angel's body in a big cardboard TV box that unfortunately for them was lined with cork and carried it outside to a yellow cab near the building. So they took the cab to the West Side Highway on 25th Street and they paid this cabbie $20 to help them lift the box out of the trunk and carry it across the street and throw it into the Hudson River. And he totally just did it. I didn't find a single thing saying the cabbie went to police. So they hauled it over the side of the bridge, drop it in the water, and surprise, the cork-lined box filled with this corp, it doesn't sink. It just floats along and goes down the river. Freeze, like, jumps up on the side of the bridge. He wants to jump in the water and deal with it, but it's March. You know, obviously, that doesn't make any sense. So Michael talks him out of it, and they get back in the car. And then the cabbie just drives them back to their apartment. So now cabbie knows, like, everything.
Just a day in the life of a New York City cab driver.
So as airtight as this whole plan seemed, the rumor mill started almost immediately. On March 17th, 1996, Angel disappeared, right? And then afterwards, Michael was sporting a 2-inch gash on the back of his neck. He had access to all of Angel's drugs. And he had totally, like, decked out his apartment, brand new furniture and a new TV. He all of a sudden had all this money and he was wearing Angel's boots.
Oh God.
Also, Michael was just straight up telling people he had killed Angel and
that part
and bragging that he had stolen about $18,000 from him.
Damn.
According to Frank Owen for the Village Voice, who wrote an article in the summer of 1996, according to his sources, Michael confessed to his friend Screaming Rachel from Chicago, Rudolph Piper, the original guy from the Danceteria, Club Kid Genitalia or Genitalia, Limelight Lighting Director Arthur Weinstein, and then Peter Gation's common-law wife, Alessandra Kobayashi. And it came out later that actually Michael had told way more people mm-hmm. than that. Those are just mm-hmm. the people that are rumored to have been told. The rumor mill itself was robust. Some of the rumors included Angel's head was cut off and in someone's freezer in Brooklyn. His hands were in Staten Island. That Freeze had had sex with the body. That
Who's Freeze? Sorry, who is this guy?
He's just another drug dealer that was hanging out.
He just randomly was just there that day.
He's like a Club Kid Entourage member.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's like more in the inner circle.
Okay, sorry, what are the other
rumors? So those are all these rumors swirling, right? And then also the rumors swirling that they had hit Angel in the head with a hammer and threw his legs away separately and kept the rest of the body in a box in the living room for over a week, that they threw the box in the Hudson River. So like a lot of stuff that's also
what happened.
The thing was at the time that lots of people were ODing, lots of people were committing suicide in the scene. Mm. People were dying and disappearing often. And, you know, at least from watching these things, you really get the sense that there was some desensitization about death and disappearance in this scene.
Yeah.
And most people who heard the rumors or even Michael's confessions from the way they knew Michael and who he was and how out of his mind on drugs he was, they thought it was like a publicity stunt or a prank or a really bad joke, right? So the box floated along until a tropical storm hit the area and it washed up on the shore on Staten Island in late March, early April. So a group of kids who were playing on the shore found Angel's body inside the box, but in a strange twist of fate, the body was misidentified. And even though Angel's family had filed a missing persons report, offered a $4,000 reward for information into his disappearance, and were canvassing New York City with flyers, no investigators made a connection between this case and the body that washed up on Staten Island. Mm-hmm. Right around the time Angel's body was discovered, Michael Alec and his friend slash fellow heroin addict and club kid Gitsy decided to leave New York City and drive to Chicago and then on to Colorado. From what I understand, the plan initially was to go to a drug rehab center in Denver, and they financed the entire trip from the money Michael had stolen from Angel. They were both severely addicted to heroin and needed to do heroin every few hours to stave off withdrawals. So their window of productivity was very small. And the trip itself ended up taking 5 weeks.
Yeah.
Along the way, they stopped at Michael's friend Screaming Rachel's house in Chicago and they told her the whole story. And she immediately turned around and wrote a trippy dance hall song called Murder in Clubland.
Oh, cute.
The song,
God, what a class act.
The song did not do well commercially, but it did include a backwards line on the track, like spoken backwards, that repeated Michael wears Angel over and over again. So it's very clearly about the situation. I think they got to Colorado. At one point, they broke into a veterinary clinic to steal some ketamine. And from what I can tell, they abandoned the rehab idea altogether and just went back to NYC. By the time Michael Alec returned to New York, all the rumors swirling around him were just straight up front page news. It started with a blind item piece in the Village Voice by Michael Musto on April 26th in his column La Dolce Musto, all about the alleged murder.
Mm-hmm.
June 25th, another Village Voice article came out, this time with names. The Bombshell, A Murder in Clubland by Frank Owens, who did most of the major reporting on the story for the Village Voice. And then, you know, other pieces like, did King of Club Kids Michael Alec really kill Angel Melendez? Or is it all a hoax? Like, these are just everywhere, not just front page news, but in every gossip column in New York, all over the place.
Joan Rivers is like, I told you we needed to be worrying about our children. Yeah, I literally told you guys.
And in this particular piece, this is all a hoax. That one actually was written quoting Screaming Rachel, who was just like spilling everything to promote her new single.
God, what a self-serving asshole. So, I mean, she just won. They're all like that. Anyways.
She like explains it. Like she goes, well, he told me and I had a nervous breakdown and I had to be institutionalized. And the only way I could process it was by writing a song.
And then promoting it heavily.
So you may be wondering at this point, why wasn't Michael Alec detained by police, questioned, named a suspect in Angel's disappearance? Well, to start, Angel's body had, like I said, been misidentified, and the police told his family there was nothing they could do without more evidence, right? There was no body. So there was no investigation into Angel's missing person case at that point. There wasn't even an investigation to connect to the body.
Right.
And then there was this other thing. I'm going to do it in really simple terms, but apparently what happened was Michael had flipped on his mentor, Peter Gation, and agreed to testify against him at his big drug trial, like, you know, racketeering trial. And the idea was officials wanted Gation more than they wanted to solve Angel Melendez's murder. So that's not like an official thing, but that's kind of what people felt at the time, that like, as long as they didn't really solve Angel Melendez's murder, they still could preserve him as this witness in this bigger trial that they wanted to pursue. So months went by with Michael Alec feeding information to the DEA and the public just assuming the rumors about Michael Alec and Angel Melendez were like a hoax or a publicity stunt. But by July, the press had uncovered so much information. An investigation into Angel's disappearance was inevitable, and police started looking into the case. Even then, though, Michael seemed to think he was unstoppable. Around September, I pulled this from one of the docs, but I couldn't figure out what it was for, but he did an on-camera interview, and he was just totally cavalier about the whole thing. He said, quote, about Angel, he was one of those copycats who we hate, so we killed him. Like, he says it as a joke. Yeah. They're like questioning him and he's like, oh yeah, we totally killed him.
I hate this like poser thing. It's like, you guys are all drug addicts and then you want to be mean to your drug dealers.
Yeah, totally. Or this guy, they're just like picking on him. It's real. I mean, it is so ugly.
Yeah.
And then he was like laughing about his jokes and he's like, oh, I killed Angel. And then it's like this big pause. And then he looks off camera and he's like, oh, that's the kind of thing that gets me in trouble. You know, like he just keeps saying like, you can tell like where these rumors came from because he's literally saying I killed Angel like several times in this interview. Again, a lot of this is a little opaque. It's not crystal clear to me. But from what I understand, around this time in the fall, there was a deal floated to Michael that he may be able to get all of his charges wrapped up together. And in exchange for testifying against Gation, he could get like 3 years total for his involvement with Angel's case and then any pending drug charges. This is something that Michael claims. I didn't read any official document about that, but he was saying like as Angel's case gained some steam, he was approached that maybe he would get a sweetheart deal. In October 1996, pumped up with drugs and a feeling of invincibility, 31-year-old club kid Michael Alec decided to breathe life back into his promoting career and launch a comeback party called the Honey Pot.
Gross.
The party failed absolutely miserably.
Good.
Nobody liked it. A couple weeks later, on November 2nd, Angel Melendez's body was finally positively identified, in part because of the detailed reporting from the Village Voice saying, oh, the rumors, this body was hit 3 times in the back of the head with a hammer. Its legs were removed. Right?
Right.
Michael, after the body was identified, Michael moved to New Jersey to get trashed and hide away in a hotel with his boyfriend, who was a heroin dealer. He was arrested for murder in early December, along with Freeze, who then confessed everything. While being held on Rikers Island, Michael's plea deal fell apart. Basically, while he was on Rikers, DEA agents kept visiting him, trying to get more information on Gation. And I'm not going to get super far into this, but the whole investigation into Peter Gation was like fraught with scandal. Basically, the DEA did a lot of like super crooked stuff. And then the witnesses mm-hmm. that they had kept turning on them and saying like, you know, actually the DEA planted this, or actually they made this piece up. So like,
right.
I think by this time they had ticked through like two other people who had turned against the DEA. And now yeah. they were like focusing on Michael Alec.
Well, Giuliani was doing all types of crazy shit to get the mob locked up at the time. And, you know, they were
when it was a racketeering case. Yeah, so yeah, I think it was yeah. that style of stuff. So anyway, this is yeah. basically what happened was he was on Rikers and the DEA agents kept visiting him and he was like going through withdrawals from heroin. And so he said, he told them, I can't answer your questions on Gation unless I get heroin. So they would check him out of Rikers Island and then drive him to his heroin dealer so he could get heroin. And they let him shoot up in the back of their unmarked car.
Damn, DEA.
It was corroborated enough uh-huh. that like that became the record. Uh-huh. So that scandal broke and Michael Alec was then dropped as a witness in the Gation case. Now, the stuff I read made it seem like it broke and he was dropped. What he says is he's the one who broke it. Like he came forward and said the DEA has been doing all this crooked stuff mm-hmm. because he wanted to get out of testifying mm-hmm. in Peter Gation's trial. So it could be either way. Sure. I couldn't really tell. Anyway, ultimately Freeze and Michael Alec were offered another plea deal, 10 to 20 years in exchange for a guilty plea of manslaughter. And they took it. The clubs were shut down one by one by the city. Peter Gation was acquitted of all charges in his drug racketeering case, but he was deported back to Canada for tax evasion. They shut down. He lost the Limelight, Palladium, Tunnel, and Club USA, and basically the whole Gation empire collapsed. Prison was a horrific place for Michael Alec. He was raped. He spent time in a psychiatric ward, and he really hardcore continued his drug use, which landed him in the hole for over 5 years. Mm. So he's in solitary for 5 years.
Yeah.
While Freeze was paroled in 2010, Alec had so many disciplinary issues. He wasn't released until 4 years later after serving 17 years in prison. By the time he was released, the world and New York City had changed completely. He had never used a cell phone. He had never been on the internet. He'd missed 9/11, you know, as a lifelong New Yorker. And the Disneyfication of Times Square, just like everything he had never seen before. When he got out of prison, a group of surviving club kids met him at the gates in a big van with a ton of booze. They drove to New York City. James St. James showed him all around the city. They had like video cameras following him. And everyone still knew him on the street. People were shouting stuff like, hey, man, welcome back. You know, keep your nose clean. Like, you know, stay out of trouble.
Okay. They're like, don't kill any more of your drug dealers, please.
Right.
Or not even. Seems like literally no one cares that Angel was murdered.
Yeah. 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 Then 6 years later, Michael died of a heroin overdose. He died on Christmas Eve 2020 after doing heroin mixed with fentanyl. Mm. And he was 54 years old.
Wow. That's crazy that it was fentanyl. Because when you were saying that whose line is it anyways
yeah.
joke or whatever, or what's my line, it's like you literally could never, ever, 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 never, ever, never do that now.
Yeah, you'd have to like test everything. I mean,
oh my God. Yeah. Fentanyl is just killing people all the time in like every circumstance. So when you said that, I was like, in my mind, I thought, oh, fentanyl. And that's crazy that that's how he ended up dying in 2020.
Yeah.
Damn. That's a brutal story, man. That's just like you just see like someone unplugs the record machine and just like slowly, you know, warbles out to silence.
Yeah,
or
right. Yeah, yeah,
damn,
yeah.
Damn, Muriel. That's like one of those things where it's like you feel like I don't know why. I feel like I've heard that story before or know it or something, but man, that is just, yeah, it's haunting on a lot of levels.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm glad Brad made it out. Thank you so much for listening to Muriel's Murders. That's Muriel, did all the research and the writing and the hosting, and I did all the computer stuff that allowed it to be inside of your ears right now. And we think it's really cool that you listen to the outro, so don't hit stop yet.
Yeah, man. Hey, thank you to Mario Castellini for doing all of our music. You can find him at Castellini Beats. He's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah, Mario just produced all the tracks on a new album by a rapper named Joey Cool, who's on Tech N9ne's Strange Music record label. That's hip hop royalty right there out of Kansas City. The album's called Enjoy the View. I'll put a link to that on Spotify in the show notes of this episode. Find us on Patreon, find us on Spotify, you know, find us on social media. You know, we try to stay up on our correspondences. We love it when you guys hit us up.
Yeah, it's really sweet.
Yeah. All right. Well, you guys are the best. What else you want
to
say, Mira?
I think that's it, man. We'll see you next week. We're going to try to put together, I think, a Patreon feature where you can like buy specific episodes, right? We're going to do that in the future.
Yeah, there's going to be some announcements. We're trying to do certain things,
there's a lot of stuff going on. But I would say this, our Patreon's really fun. We've got a lot of really fun stuff on there. Like stuff that I was like, oh man, I wish I could put that on the main feed. So, you know.
Yeah, I think every episode is kind of like that. We're like, ooh, that one was like really good. But I feel that way about our main feed ones too. So yeah.
We're just talented. Well, we love us.
We love us.
And we love you. You all have a good ass week.
Bye.
Bye.